Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for November 18th, 2010. I'm reporter Elise Hugh, joined by CEO and editor-in-chief Evan Smith.
Hello.
Managing editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
And Ben Philpott from the Tribune and KUT News.
Hello.
Welcome back from vacation, Ben.
Ah, it was lovely.
We missed you. Our three topics this week are the speaker's race, the latest in what's happening in the challenge to Speaker Joe Strauss, budget woes, ongoing confusion over how big the size of our shortfall actually is, and how governing is hard, a topic that will be led by Evan. I'll start first.
It's a good topic.
Oh boy. Stay tuned, kids.
Have faith. It's a good topic.
Don't touch that dial. I'll start with just an update on what's happening in the speaker's race. A lot more talk now of a GOP caucus meeting in order to choose a speaker. This is something that Warren Chisholm called for the day after the election, arguing that the next speaker is largely going to be chosen by Republicans, so Republicans should make the first decision on a consensus speaker candidate.
So they ought to just go in a room without the Democrats, pick the speaker, and that's their speaker.
And then stick it in the Democrats' ears.
Right.
Right.
Which like is how it works in Washington.
Like everything else this session.
Well, it's how it works in Washington and you know, a lot of other states.
I talked to GOP, I guess, House Majority Leader Larry Taylor.
Caucus?
What is it? Yeah, he's actually the head of the House Republican Caucus.
Okay. Larry Taylor said to me on Tuesday that he is polling all the members. They're trying to reach all 99. And he said, you know, it's a lot of people to try and reach, so give me a couple days to find out whether they want to meet. And so before the end of this week, they're going to decide, or he will decide, whether to call a meeting.
And there's a couple of members, Dan Branch and some others, who've raised some questions about whether you can actually pick a speaker this way, whether the law allows it.
Well, they're not picking a speaker this way.
Well, they are.
Well, they're not. So what they're doing is they're picking a candidate who they believe should be put forward as the one true candidate.
And pledging to support that candidate when it gets to the floor on January 11th.
But isn't that what a pledge card
And you
does?
Believe because the numbers are so enormous.
If the caucus says we're going to do it, it's done.
Is this good or bad for Strauss? Strauss has said, you know, I feel very confident in my leadership, so I'm okay with
it. Is it an open ballot?
That's another question, actually, that's right? coming up, right? Open or secret ballot within the caucus meeting. So he hasn't shunned the idea of a caucus meeting, but clearly his lieutenants are raising questions about having it at all.
The only guy who's actually shunned the idea of a caucus meeting on paper is Warren Chisholm.
Because?
Who did it when he was running against Craddock. Back in 2003, said that we shouldn't pick the speaker in caucus. We should pick the speaker on the floor and do this the way the House has always done it. He and some other guys all signed this letter. So Strauss actually sort of took a little bit of pleasure in pointing out that the only guy who's been against this on paper is Warren, and I'm curious why he's
so Warren is pushing it now, having opposed it previously.
Right.
Strauss is for it or against it.
Strauss said he's open to the idea,
and Strauss is confident enough in the numbers.
Well, he says he's got enough Republicans here, right? Mm-hmm. But if you went into caucus, I think the first day, Elise helped me, he said 79 Republicans?
76 or something like, or close. It's in that ballpark.
He had well over half of 99, right? In fact, he had well over half. He had enough Republicans to win in the full House
without a single Democratic vote.
Right. So the question is, you know, what happens if Strauss goes into caucus? Does the caucus go further right than the rest of the House would?
Yeah.
It has this play.
And are the only people in the room the 99, or is there a direct line to Michael Quinn Sullivan and Peter Morrison and the outside players who, while denying strenuously that they've been involved in this race, do so without much credibility since their involvement seems to be...
Well, they haven't denied they're not involved. They have denied that they're trying to knock Strauss off. They've
right.
just
well,
said,
but
you know, we should have a conservative
speaker. But that's tantamount right. to denying that they're involved. The reality is they're not involved because they're playing Parcheesi. They're involved because they want a particular outcome. And the outcome that they seem to want is the end of the Strauss era. And, you know, the degree to which the outside forces have played a role in the speaker's race is one of the many interesting aspects of the narrative this time.
There was a lawsuit that was ruled on in federal court a year ago, filed by this weird alliance of the Liberty Institute, which is a very conservative group, mostly out of Dallas, Kelly Shackelford and some folks
Jonathan
up there.
Jonathan Sines, right?
Right,
along with the ACLU, which joined them in this lawsuit and basically said, you know, the judge basically said that the part of the law that prevents outside groups from participating in a speaker's race is unconstitutional, that this is a legislative vote, that you should be able to lobby your legislator to affect his or her vote on this or any other matter before the legislature.
Right.
And so what we're seeing to some extent this time is the first speaker's race after that ruling.
Well, I'm not suggesting that there's anything untoward or inappropriate about the involvement of the third parties or the outside parties. Let me be clear about that. I'm just acknowledging the fact that there is involvement.
Yeah, they're playing.
And the interesting thing is the accusation that was leveled against Strauss by Brian Hughes last week was that Strauss is threatening to exact revenge on people who don't support him, when in fact it is the other side that is allegedly threatening to exact revenge. If you don't support someone other than Strauss, you will get a primary challenger, is the threat that is being bandied about, apparently.
This is the one from Peter Morrison, I guess.
Well, and others, you know. Right. You know, the entire speaker's race is being conducted in the comments section of Paul Burka's blog. And if you read if you read the comments on Burka's blog, you would understand that what's going on here is not so subtle pressure by the non-Strauss folks, the anti-Strauss folks, saying basically, if you side with Strauss, then you're in trouble, buddy.
Not so subtle at all. I mean, I have sources in San Antonio and in Dallas who are saying that there are robocalls going on in both those areas saying, you know, you have to be a good Christian. And
well,
but
and we haven't even mentioned the barely veiled anti-Semitism against Strauss.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I, of course, find I'm a Jew, so I'm going to show my hand right now and say, oy vey, this is terrible. I find the even the suggestion through code words or anything else of Strauss's religion having anything at all to do with this matter to be abhorrent. But unfortunately, we are in knife fight politics mode right now.
Right.
And, you know, I'm going to say something that I said previously on this podcast. There is such a thing as the sin of overreach. The same people who got Chris Coons elected in Delaware and got Lisa Murkowski elected in Alaska and got Michael Bennett elected in Colorado to the U.S. Senate in those cases by overreaching are threatening to overreach here. You know, the Republicans had a huge victory on Election Day, and what they're doing is not good for the Republican Party. It's bad.
If Strauss indeed has 76 Republicans in that caucus, then we're talking about an insurgency that's very small, just very loud.
Right.
I mean, there's actually not that many people involved.
Well,
in this
it's Paxton and Laubenberg and Tan Parker and Chisholm,
sure,
and Berman.
Riddle.
Berman, who today, did you notice Berman today in the Lubbock Avalanche Journal was denying that Barack Obama had an American birth certificate?
There you go.
After all this time,
right.
Leo, really? Shall I walk it over to your office, Leo? You can hate on the guy, but he's an American. But this is the group, though.
Right. So yeah, you know, this stops being strategy at this point and starts being tactical. I mean, you've got this 60-day run that every speaker has to survive in order to get reelected, and it's roughly 60 days. It's the time between the election of the members who will vote for speaker and the time that the legislature comes in January and actually votes on the speaker. So if you're a speaker, this is when you're sort of out there without cover. Strauss has to survive until January 11th in order for this to work. So tactically, what do you do if you're Strauss? You want to twist in the wind for 60 days or you want to cut it off? You want to cut it off. So the first thing you do is you pop out a list and say, I have 126 votes out of the 150 we need.
And people like us say that the list is only as good as the paper it's printed on, right? It's not that
right.
Not conclusive.
They have been known to flake before. They have been known to change their minds. You have this new period, like I said, where you've got the ability, you've got this newly ratified ability of outside groups to play in this thing. And so they want to keep this alive for a while. If Strauss has the votes in Republican caucus, and if that's where the danger to him is, then he ought to jump in there and get the votes and just cut this thing off.
You were talking about overreaching. I mean, considering there are 99 Republicans in the House, people that fight over the speaker's race, you know, they want power back. The people who were the Craddock disciples, you know, they lost power when Strauss came in. They now want it back. But with 99 Republicans in the House, I mean, weren't people like Warren Chisholm and others already in line to regain committee chairs because of the new makeup of the House?
It's not enough. The rap on Strauss is that he appointed people to chair committees, both Republicans and Democrats, who are insufficiently doctrinaire conservative. And they believe that the message of the people on Election Day in this country and in this state was not just we want Republicans and conservatives, but we want super conservatives. We want it is a matter of degrees that they want. Would you agree with that, Ross?
Yeah, Mark Davis had a really interesting column. This is the radio talk show host up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. He had an interesting column the other day where he was saying, you know, Joe Strauss comes into a House last time that was 76 Republicans and 74 Democrats and said, I want to let the House run itself. And having that number and that philosophy forces him to run a centrist House. What Strauss is saying now, what Davis said in his column, I thought was kind of interesting, is if Strauss is still taking the attitude, which he seems to be, of let the House run the House, 99 Republicans and 51 Democrats is going to be a much more conservative House, whether Strauss intervenes or not. He's basically saying, look, I'm just the manager here. I'm here to stop the fights. I'm here to make this stuff work. I'm not here to decide issues. Sure. That's not the job of a speaker.
The thing I want to observe before we move on is that, you know, the notion of what Joe Strauss does now, if Tom Craddock were speaker and this were going on, you know, it'd be like the scene in The Departed where they throw Martin Sheen's body off the building, or, you know, or it'd be like the scene in The Godfather where you wake up with the horse's head in your bed. You pick your cinematic analogy. The reality is Strauss needs to kill a guy. Strauss needs to put Phil King's body out in front of the Capitol or something. I really believe that over the last week, Strauss's footing has gotten less stable. Doesn't mean Strauss is not going to be speaker. I personally believe that as of today, Strauss continues to be speaker. But his toughness is being questioned.
Well, that's exactly the question, right? Here is that, you know, this is a guy who's, it's not really a judgment of him. He hasn't been tested in this thing. These guys want to know if they've got a weak speaker or a strong one. If they've got a weak one, they'll pull him down.
You don't show up to a knife fight with a butter knife. That's the point.
If they've got a strong one, you know, we'll find out in the next 50 days or so.
Yeah.
Let's switch over to their biggest task ahead when the legislature reconvenes and the budget. Ross?
They don't know exactly how big the hole is going to be. We've talked about this before. You know, you start with the number, here's how much money you're going to have. Then you come up with a number that says, here's how much money we need. And both of those are political to some extent, especially the second one, because you can come in and say, the government should continue to do all of the things that it does now, and that costs this much. You can come in and say, if we got the government we really needed, it would only cost this much, and that's a lower number. So there's some politics there. They got some numbers this week that are a little bit less political. One of them is the state budget, the discretionary part of the state budget's only going to be allowed to grow about 9%. They pick a number and say this is how fast the economy's growing. They can get a budget that's bigger than that, but only with a 4/5 vote. You have to have basically everybody on board. So they've set the growth of the discretionary part of the budget at 9%. So the budget isn't going to grow much, whatever the shortfall is. The second thing that they did this week was that Joe Strauss and David Dewhurst, lieutenant governor, at the head of the LBB said, you know, we've got a year left or less than a year left in the current budget, but we want the agencies to cut 2 or 3% more out of their budgets now. So the screws are still tightening. That's not a sign that they think things are getting better. That's not a sign that they think the incline of this hill is any better. And I guess Susan Combs is, we're waiting for Susan Combs to pop out a number. She continues to be coy.
Are we also looking at a situation for this biennium where we're going to end the year in the wrong direction that we suddenly have to make back up?
Yeah, there was a cash balance report. We read these so you don't have to.
Right.
There was a cash balance
report. Sometimes even we don't read them.
Right. They said that currently we're headed toward a deficit, an actual deficit in the current budget of $1.4 billion. It's pretty normal at the beginning of a legislative session for them to come in with what they call a supplemental appropriations bill. Basically, they come in and they say, without saying it, we don't have enough money in the current budget to cover current costs. They start their sessions, we'll back up a minute. They start their sessions in January, and they're at the point in January, they're still in the current budget until August. So they come in January and they say, we don't have enough money to cover the last 8 months, so let's pass a supplemental appropriations bill in order to cover the costs in front of us.
But
that's going to be a pretty big bill this time.
But the people who were elected and said, we don't want to spend any money, are now suddenly going to have to come in, and the first vote they're going to have to cast is to just basically artificially raise the debt ceiling, or the equivalent.
Well, not really.
Of that.
I mean, they'll pass an appropriations bill that says this covers the cost that we've
got.
And
the money's going to come from where?
Well, depends on what Combs says we have for money.
This is so fabulous.
They basically short sheet the bed. They write a 2-year budget. They short sheet the bed. They say, okay, this balance is on paper. They get to some point in that budget period where we are now, and they say, you know, the revenue estimates that we had and the cost estimates that we had were a little bit off. We got to adjust this thing. We're going to have a supplemental appropriations bill. Right now, that's a $3 to $5 billion bill, right? And then they come in right after that and say, okay, now let's write the next 2-year budget. And in 2 years from now, we'll write a supplemental to fix whatever's wrong with that. You have a very skeptical look on your face.
A $3 to $5
billion? Yeah.
Shouldn't I have a skeptical look on my face?
One of the things I think is really interesting, kind of in the broader context of all this, is that we are competing against California again, but this time with the size of our budget shortfall. California's budget shortfall is estimated at something like 19, so we could beat them. And well, they're
but it was California at one point. California is a high services state, too. I mean, California had a little bit of an advantage here, if you can call it that, of they were cutting
more meat
fat
on the bone.
They were cutting fat from fat programs. Texas is a low services state, and if you say we're going to cut something, you're basically saying either we're going to take a program we have now and not do it as well as we're doing it, right? We're going to put three wheels on the car, Dave McNeely's analogy, or we're going to cut programs that we think we need. If I went back and checked the numbers, it's true that if the budget shortfall is in the $20 billion range, you can cut everything in state government that's not health and human services, not higher and public ed, and you're not there yet. So they're going to have to cut something in higher ed, public ed, health and human services in order to balance this thing. And those aren't programs where we have a lot of luxury services.
And the people in those environments are freaked out. I talked to the chancellor of one of the smaller state university systems last night, who said the problem that I have going into this cut my budget cycle is that we run pretty lean already.
Right.
And, you know, the problem with my predecessor, this person said, is that my predecessor ran a very lean operation. So I inherit a lean operation, and now suddenly I've got to cut this percentage, and I don't have a whole lot of fat to cut.
Right.
What do I do?
Right.
It's a legitimate concern. All across the state, public school people, higher ed people, healthcare people are flipped out about exactly the math that you talked about.
Right. Well, you know, economists have always said Texas is last into the recession and first out, or coming out of the recession as the rest of the country comes out of the recession. I think there have been a handful of economists that have said that, you know, we were the last state to go into this current recession, and we did come out as early as any other states did. But now, you know, my boss over at KUT thinks that maybe we're going to, you know, create our own recession by the jobs that are going to be lost and the money that's not going to be spent
government
over this
jobs.
Next budget cycle.
Well, I want to also observe on the rainy day fund, by the way. I happened to see the comptroller speak last night at a function that was not a public function, but it was not expressly off the record.
Right.
What I'll simply say about her comments is that she talked about the size of the rainy day fund as smaller than I thought it was. You know, people are bandying about that, oh, we have about $9 billion.
Right.
No. She talked about it being 7.6 or 7.8 billion as of now, and that the hope was that it would be 8.2 by the end of this year.
Oh, you that's know, interesting.
That's not very much.
Right.
I mean, it's even less than I thought it was going to be. And if they're talking about using part or all of the rainy day fund, even if they used all of it, it may not solve as much of the problem as they want.
Right.
I guess the difficulty of this problem kind of segues well into your topic, Evan, and how governing is hard.
Well, you know, the thing that's going to be so interesting is all these old boys who got elected, who'd never been in office before, who'd been working in the drugstore in some C county.
Subway.
Had never run for office, and they decided to run, and they either decided to run because they were legitimately angry at the incumbent or legitimately angry at the president, or they were somehow dragooned into running thinking that it was a fool's errand and they'd never win. And they woke up the next day and they found, I'm elected to the Texas House. Now they're going to come to Austin and they're going to discover that it's easy to campaign. It's easy to talk about strangling government in the cradle. It's easy to talk about cutting government. But now you suddenly have to cut government of the people who elected you. You have to make decisions that are ultimately going to affect the people who sent you there. And it's a hard, you know, governing is hard. Decision making is hard.
Right.
When you get to Austin, you discover that you're not just, quote, cutting government in the abstract. You actually have to get in there and cut stuff. And cut. I'm not just cutting government. I'm cutting the government of the people who elected me. I'm cutting their schools.
Think about the new newly elected rural representatives who will find out that yes, it actually probably would save the state some money if you consolidated rural high schools or rural school districts. Do you think that's going to fly?
And then you're going to be run out of town.
Right. Exactly.
Right, for destroying the football program.
Exactly.
Or whatever. It's hard stuff.
It's always the problem. I mean, it's that old line. It's true that every line of the state budget has a constituency. Every number in that budget has a constituency, and some of them are noisy voting constituencies in places where you wouldn't think. If you cut Medicaid, you know, the biggest, I think this is right, I think the biggest single program in Medicaid, maybe nursing homes, you know, there's a third rail. You know,
who wants it? Who wants
to go? Rural areas are highly, yeah.
Right. Who wants to go home and say, I did what I said? By the way, I did what I said I was going to do.
And I closed your nursing home.
I threw grandma out in the street.
And closed down your largest employer in our county.
Right.
There's a funny little...
There's the employment problem,
There's
too,
a funny little historical thing in the Texas House. Nobody who has headed the Appropriations Committee, which writes the budget, has gone on to become speaker. Because you spend all your time saying no, cutting budgets. It's just one of those...
Name a past chair of the Appropriations Committee who's running for speaker.
Yeah. It just hadn't happened yet.
Doesn't bode well.
It could happen at any time, I guess. You know, Jim Rudd came close. But, you know, it's just an interesting little
So you're going to be in a position, if you're one of these members who was just elected, you're going to be in a position of having to go back after the session and say either, you know what, I couldn't cut government the way I promised. Or, you know what, I did what I promised. And what I cut was your schools and your health care. And all your other government programs.
Well, and
it's
made
very hard for these guys to go back to their districts having promised this.
I think a lot of voters, you know, we'll find out how many of them, but I think a lot of voters want them to do that. I think a lot of people look at this as an opportunity to actually say, you know, the people who think government's too big look at this as a golden opportunity to prove the case. Let's cut this thing back. Let's see if it really does matter to people. And if it does, you know, we can deal with that then. But right now, the mission is to come to Austin and cut this thing down.
The metaphor for this election cycle, not just in Texas, but for the whole country, is going to be this poor bastard who got elected to Congress and showed up this week. You probably read the story. He got elected to Congress complaining about government spending, and he was pissed off that he had to wait a month for his government-provided health care to kick in. And he was caught on video kicking and screaming about the fact that as much as he hated government-run health care and Obamacare, and that's what he campaigned against, he discovered that he, as a member of Congress, got government-run health care, and it wasn't kicking in fast enough. He had to wait a month for his enrollment period.
Well, here's a great symbolic cut.
The hypocrisy. But we know this is going to be a theme all year long.
Absolutely.
There's a great symbolic cut. You know, if you go to the legislature and you say, okay, so you guys are a part-time legislature, right? You're a part-time citizen legislature. You're part-timers. How come you get full-time health benefits from the state? How come you get the same health benefits?
They have a great pension, too.
Full-time employees get. You have these great pensions. Physician, heal thyself.
Seriously.
Right?
Seriously. I mean,
Story idea.
This stuff is hard. It is much more complicated than a campaign allows you to talk about.
If you have any questions or comments for the podcast, you can email us at podcasts@texastribune.org. On behalf of Evan, Ross, Ben, and our podcast producer, Todd, I'm Elise. Thanks for listening.